Accession number 28457, Reel 5.
Nigel Matthews, Reel 5. Can I ask you what your role or your job as an observer involved?
Well, because I was a regular officer, in the time scale in which I was operating, although I said I went to Arbroath, we did spend a few weeks at Eastleigh and doing preliminary training, and I went for an air experience trip with an aircraft that came from Leon Cernan, actually, and it was driven by Rafe Richardson. He was the pilot. But I got my second stripe when I was just after being 21 at Eastleigh. And then we had two straight stripes on our arm, and all these other chaps who came in from, you know, off the streets were all sub-lieutenants, A, wavy stripe, R and VRs. So one was in a position of superiority, if you like, with these chaps. And so wherever one went, one tended to be sent a senior observer, in which case you were responsible for the other observers in the squadron, for their training, for what they did, how they did it, and generally sort of helping out the CO. And you used to fly with the CO. This was a normal thing. But this didn't happen for some time until after our birth, because we now come to a chapter in which I had my pleasurable war. After our birth, at the end of our birth, when we were qualified, we were all...
Sorry to interrupt, but that would have been in early 1941.
I think so. Yes. We had to state a preference where we wanted to go. And so everybody put down Cape Town. And I was one of the lucky ones because I got allocated to Cape Town. And the first intimation I had of this, we won't go into this too deep because it's really rather relevant, was that I was to report to a merchant shipping office in London, where I was told to join a ship at tail of the bank at Greenock and go to South Africa. And I'd be told what to do.
So you travelled on a merchant ship?
I travelled on a merchant ship. And there were 125 passengers on the ship. 7,000 tons of sort of mixed cargo and so on. And it was a pretty extraordinary trip, actually, because there were 10 naval officers, 110 passengers, of which 100, or 80 or 90, were ladies. So we had quite an enjoyable trip, really. Anyway, we got to Cape Town. And they then said, and the fleet was just getting itself into difficulties, Far Eastern fleet it was, with the Japanese coming down through Malaysia into Singapore, and then across even to Colombo. And the fleet was falling back on East Africa. So the pool of officers who had arrived in Cape Town were told that they would shortly be going up to East Africa. And we spent a month in Cape Town, which was great fun, and not in any way warlike. And we then took a train, which is another model trip, to Durban. And then we took a troop ship, which took us up to East Africa. And I then spent the best part of 18 months in East Africa. And that's a lovely way to fight a war.
So you arrived in East Africa. Which part of East Africa?
We went to Mombasa, which was the port, and at that time the Fleet Air Arm had a maintenance engineering base in Nairobi, but it had a number of outlying fields, one of which was a place called McKinnon Road, which was about 70-80 miles inland from Mombasa, it's the veld, it's not jungle, it's sort of open field, thorn bushes, but in really wildest Africa. It's just the railway line that goes up Nairobi. And the whole thing was absolutely wonderful. there was this little encampment on this airstrip. We had these airplanes, there were some fighters and some albacores we flew. And I can remember the first day I got out of the train, which left Mombasa at 5 o'clock every evening, trundled up this government onto the plane, and got there about 7, 8 o'clock, went in, had a meal in the mess, which was under canvas. And when I got up out of my tent in the morning, the whole of the airstrip was covered with game, all sorts, zebra, wildebeest, everything, fantastic, never seen anything like it. Anyway, we did some flying from there, from navigation exercises. And then they said, we're going to go to Madagascar. So six of us went in albacores, and six formers, which were the fighters, and we embarked in Formidable at Mombasa. And then they decided they weren't going to take us to Madagascar in the ship. So we went to sea in the ship, and we flew off it. And we landed at a place that people only go to now in cruise ships, called Mayotte, which was a very small French island about 100 miles off to the east of Mombasa. And there's a group of islands called the Comoros, and one of these islands called Mayotte. And they had an airstrip they'd sort of made. We landed there, spent a night with the French, and then flew on to Majunga in Madagascar, where we spent about 6 weeks.
But was this the first time you'd taken off from a ship, or had you done that during the course of your training?
Good question. No, I hadn't done it before, I don't think. But there was nothing to it. I'll tell you something afterwards, which will be another part of the story. Anyway, we went to Madagascar, and we fought a funny war there, supporting the army, and we went inland up to Tananarive, the capital, down to a sort of spa place called Ansira Bay, and there were the odd encounters with African troops, who were all remarkable marksmen, because there were insurgents in Madagascar who had to be put down. So we did that for about 6 weeks. And then we flew back to...
Before we move on from that, perhaps you would talk a little more about the living conditions and where you flew off from.
Well, the whole thing was under canvas. And there were six albacores, which were sort of development of the swordfish, but covered up, and biplane, and six formers. And we went around as a sort of squadron mix, and there were some South Africans, Blenheims, which shared some of the operations with us. And for part of the time, we were under their operational orders. But we lived under canvas, and we would fly, I suppose, once every other day, about mostly on patrol, doing rickeys for the army, and occasionally going on a strike of some sort, because the army thought they'd got something they wanted to bomb, and so we did that. But the living was strictly sort of Boy Scout time, you know. And we actually acclimatized ourselves quite admirably to a very weird life. We had a New Zealander amongst us, and he was an expert at living in the bush. And we were trying to cook chickens, because the conditions were very primitive. And he took charge of this, and he said, I know what we'll do. And all the petrol came in 4-gallon drums. Thin aluminium drums, about that high and that wide. And he emptied they were emptied. And he cut off the tops of them, and so that you just had a hole and this tin. And if you put a chicken inside it and cooked it like an oven on an open fire, it was absolutely wonderful. And so we had quite a lot of chicken in an early form of New Zealand oven. And but the life was very, rather like putting the clock back to the days when one... what is the word? and went around sort of living off what you could find. You could go to the local markets, and I could speak French, so that was a help. And you could buy lovely fruits and vegetables there. You could do these chickens, which people would sell you. We had a motorbike, in which we did a number of rather wild excursions and things like that.
Presumably, how many of you were there in the squad?
Oh, well, all together. There were three people for every aeroplane, so there were about 24.
An air gunner.
Yes. And so there were about 50 aircrew, about. And some ground crew, of course. Well, so about 150 altogether.
And were you under the command of the Navy still? Or were you on loan to the Army, as it were?
Well, that's a very good question. We were really under overall command, I think, of GOC East Africa. But these South African aircraft, which were attached to the Air Force, had a direct operational command on us. But as the aircraft was so totally different and did different things, really they said, well, can you do this or can you do that? We think you might like to do this. We said, yeah, sure, fine, we'll do it. And that was it. But after a bit, they had bigger airplanes, so they couldn't get into where we could go. And so when we went up to Tananarivo, which was the capital, we ran our own show, really, and did what we were told.
And basic things like, how did you get paid in those circumstances?
I have no idea. But it's a funny thing about this, that the army that runs all these logistics when you're away from the sea do have the most astonishing system. The money always turns up. I don't know how they do it, but they do. And, I think that's the answer to that.
And how was the camp run? I mean, did you have a wardroom? Did you have...
Oh, yes, we called it the wardroom, and we arranged it, but one does. One sort of all mucks in, and you arrange the thing under some sort of naval traditional setup, you know, keep the ratings separate, have a thing for the chiefs, and it all works very well. But it's run informally, but with a total understanding that you've got to get on with getting it right, the operational side of it, and being able to operate your airplanes, and if you have to go off on operations, to do it.
Did you do any night flying?
Very little. I mean, very, very, very little. We did some, well, after it, I can mention night flying. We did do a bit after that.
And were you supported by, I can't remember the name of it, the aircraft carrier that you'd originally...
No, we weren't, no. We were left to our own devices. We were put ashore at Majunga, having flown Hedgehog, and we just managed the logistics of what we had with us. And we spent, as I say, 6 weeks there, and then we flew back. And we fly back to McKinnon Road, a place called Tanga, which is on the coast, just below the border between Kenya and what is now Tanzania, what was then Tanganyika. And there was an airstrip there. And we eventually converted our aeroplanes, and I was there for 18 months. But it was there was a proper encampment. They built it locally, and we had these rather nice sort of wooden and reed huts, quite big, one of them big enough to produce a reasonable wardrobe. And it was really quite amazing. We were able to set up this encampment quite formally. And of course there wasn't any war going on. It was really like living in, I hesitate to use the word paradise. We really had a very nice time. And if you wanted to go on leave, well then you could always take one of your airplanes or get a pilot to take you to Nairobi, where there were flesh pots galore. However, there was one interlude, and that was that a number of Japanese submarines began to come across from the Indian Ocean, because the fleet had fallen back from Colombo totally and was virtually based on Mombasa. And there was one terrible disaster involving a troop ship laden mostly with wrens and families going back to Colombo as the threat diminished. And it was torpedoed about 150-200 miles east of Mombasa, and everybody was lost. Anyway, as a result of that, they instituted a series of submarine patrols, and we did quite a lot of anti-submarine patrols for a short time. Never saw anything, but we did it 24 hours round the clock, so we did some night flying then. And then gradually we began to better aircraft began to appear. And meanwhile, elsewhere in the world, the war was getting on with the war. And what was happening in North Africa was that the 8th Army had fallen back onto Egypt. And they were very, very short of aircraft. And the offensive which Montgomery had in mind, which resulted eventually in Alamein, was, people were aware of it, though it was still very secret. We weren't aware of it. But anyway, the edict went out that they wanted every available aircraft to go to reinforce the 8th Army. So we flew from Tanga to Nairobi, and then all the way up the Nile in these aircraft, which were albacores then, and we had some seafires as well, because they had just come in. And we put down at all sorts of places like Juba and Khartoum and Malakan, Assiut, because the planes were limited in their range. Couldn't fly any further. Really, it was an epic sort of trip. Because we put down, an astonishing thing was, wherever we went, a place like Juba, for example, there was nothing but an ordinary airstrip cut out of the jungle, which there was not deep trees, but mostly sort of corn up to here, sort of thing. And out of the corn would come a queue, a little crocodile of Africans, each with a 4-gallon petrol drum on their heads, to refuel the aircraft. And the logistics support was absolutely extraordinary. And Khartoum, of course, was the junction for the Spitfire reinforcements coming across from West Africa, where they'd been disembarked, put together, flown across to Khartoum, and then up the Nile to join up with the Air Force in the Desert Air Force. And we were a sort of part of this.
Can I, before we move on to that most new chapter, how long were you in East Africa for, or in all?
18 months.
So that would have been from 1940.
When was that? Man, I can't remember. Anyway. 41,
42. 42, all right. And I was going to ask you, during that period, how did you keep in contact with home?
Not much. There were very good things called airmail letter cards, which we used to have them here quite a long time after the war, but not anymore. And they were one sheet of paper. You could fill them up and they went by. And the mail throughout the whole of the war was one of the most remarkable things. Wherever you went, the mail turned up. They used to have a BFPO, British Field Post Office, and the army dealt with it all. And it just had the right number, and then people addressed it from home, and it got to you. And it got back. Quite astonishing.
And did you have to wear a particular kind of uniform when you were in East Africa?
Oh, only because it was tropical uniform.
Yes,
I mean, khaki shorts and khaki things with shoulder straps, same way. And
how long did that, as you put it, epic trip up to the north?
Oh, that took about... Well, it took about, I suppose, about 7 to 8 days to get up there. And then we went to a place called Fayed, which is an RAF base. And we were there for a while because they said we have to go back to Mombasa. And we were sent back to Mombasa on the Imperial Airways flying boat, which was not a bad thing to do. Very luxurious in those days. I mean, really, people just didn't do it. Amazing.
Can you describe what it was like?
Well, yeah. Of course, you wouldn't know what a Sunderland flight would. But there were the RAF had a large number I think it's called Sandon flying boats, built by Shorts in Belfast. Big flying boats. And they were used for Battle of the Atlantic. But meanwhile, they were a development, evolution, from the Imperial Airways flying boats. And these were part of the old British Empire flying boats. And they went all over the world where there was water. So you'd find them in Iraq, landing on the Euphrates. You'd find them in Karachi, landing on the sea. And they flew out to the Far East, they flew away. Very slow, and it did about 120 miles an hour, that sort of thing. But they went for a long way. They were extremely comfortable. And those of them, people who went on them, of course, got well treated. I mean, they got stewards, lavish cocktails, and lot, the works. Well, not quite sure about the cocktails, but anyway, they were drink, and it was damn good food. One of the ones that flew, one of the lines, was one that went from London to Cape Town. And they used to fly down to the Med, and then into Cairo, and then down the Nile, putting down at babies like Wadi Halfa, Khartoum, and then not Nairobi, but on Lake Victoria, Lake Tanganyika, all the way down, landing on the water, till they got to Cape Town. And we got on one of these, they got us some seats, and we flew from Egypt down to Mombasa, actually, and we put down at Wadi Halfa, and we put down somewhere else on the way. Can't remember the name. Oh, yes. We put down at Kisumu, and then we put down Mombasa.
Did they have beds on board?
No, they had comfy reclining seats. Not very comfy by today's standards, but they were by that. So, anyway.
So, you effectively delivered your planes to North Africa, and you were sick.
Yes.
And what happened to you after that?
Well, all good things come to an end, and I was redeployed. Time I went home. Time I did some carrier time, because I'd done virtually no carrier time. So we went back in a troop ship from Mombasa to Cairo, or Fayed rather, through the canal, and then in another troop ship to when did we go to? Another troop ship to, I think it was Tripoli. And anyway, then back home. And when I got home, I was sent to Implacable, which was the latest, biggest, and best aircraft carrier. She and Indefatigable were the two last big carriers. And I joined her at I joined the squadron, which was 8-2 814 at Macrahenish, which is in the Western Isles. And I discovered, to my considerable alarm, that the squadron was equipped with Barracudas. Now, the Barracuda was a really bad aeroplane. It was built by Fairies. It was supposed to be the Brits' answer to some of the American strike aircraft, but it looked like nothing on earth. Aviators have a thing, they say, if an aircraft looks all right, chances are it probably is all right. But this one looked horrible. It was an ungainly beast with wings, a wing up here, and undercarriage rather like a sort of praying mantis type of thing. And it had these fantastic flaps. But it could do incredible things. It was designed as a torpedo dive bomber. So it would carry a torpedo. If you put the dive brakes up, you could actually do what a Stuka did, German Stuka. You could tip it up on its nose and it would just go down there quite slowly, I mean, you know, about 90 miles an hour, maintaining its speed. And then you could either dropped your bombs, or you could go down, as we were doing at Mechohenish, doing these torpedo dummy attacks, turning in on the water, upping the flaps and going in, firing off, that sort of thing. Extremely exciting, to say the least of it. And even more so at the moment when you turned in near the water, where quite a number of aircraft went in and their crews were lost because the wings folded up.
Was the wings?
Folded. Couldn't take the strain, they broke off. Anyway, but the Barracuda had some success against the Tirpitz, which at that time was anchored or operating from northern Norwegian waters. And when we finished our training at Mechohenish, instead of joining Implacable, which was our ship, we went to Formidable, which had come back, and we joined her for one operation, which in fact never took place with us. She did an operation on the Tirpitz, but not with us. And then Implacable appeared, and we transferred to her. And we didn't do an operation on Tirpitz. We sailed for one, because they were determined to put an end to it. But the RAF produced the answer with their Lancasters and dropping their big bombs on Tirpitz at anchor. And so there was no need for us. So
Nigel Matthews, Reel 6.